Welcome to the Impactful Innovators podcast series. This series is produced from the fall 2020 class at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute and sponsored by the National Science Foundation and the Severino Center for Technological Entrepreneurship at RPI. This series highlights the stories of entrepreneurs and innovators as they go through the challenging process of changing the world. If you enjoyed the podcast, please subscribe to the Severino Center for Technological Entrepreneurship on YouTube or connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. We hope that this series will help inspire the next generation of innovators, entrepreneurs, and intrapreneurs at Rensselaer and beyond. Today's episode will feature Bill Fosnight, class of 1992, and is the co-founder and chief development officer at Alert Innovation. He is responsible for the design and development of manufacturing automation and software systems worldwide. From 2010 to 2016, he was a senior director of manufacturing technology at GlobalFoundries. Prior to joining GlobalFoundries in 2010, Bill was a senior vice president of engineering at Brooks Automation. In this position, he led the development and commercialization of factory automation and semiconductor process equipment. Prior to Brooks, Bill worked with Assist Technologies, where he managed product development in IBM, where he conducted semiconductor manufacturing research. Bill has been awarded 46 patents in manufacturing automation over the course of his 28-year career. He holds a Master's of Science in Mechanical Engineering from Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute and an MBA from Cornell University.
Good afternoon. It's nice to be back at RPI. So what I'd like to do, I'll cover several topics today. I have a fair number of videos and pictures, and I'll try to, most importantly, maybe weave in some stories of what it's like trying to start up an automation company. I think the thing I want to emphasize, and probably be a recurring theme, is thinking about your network and your reputation. So as I go through these stories, I think you'll find there's a lot of places where there's the importance of who I've connected with and how that relationship played out that came back in life and really mattered. I have the outline here on the left. I'll talk a little bit about how we found our partner and our customer, as well as building a team, developing the technology, and talk a little bit more about business and opportunities and our vision at the end. Our product is called AlphaBot, and I have a very strong partner, John Lert, who was the founder. I go as co-founders, like pilot and co-pilot. But John was someone that I met, and this is already a story of networking. He hired away my best engineer in a previous company. So he wasn't my favorite guy maybe at the time, but that opened the door, and maybe it's good never to burn bridges. I followed up with John later in life, and when he was thinking about doing this startup, we reconnected. But John had been thinking about how to automate supermarkets. It was a passion he had for 25 years. And this all started in the time of 1994. So John was thinking about, how could we use robotics or automation to make grocery stores more efficient for the retailer as well as a better experience for the customer? And it was interesting. Some of his early ideas, you would be shipped a catalog and you would have to enter your order with a dial-up modem. So that was some of the original things he talked about back then. This was his original concept, and this is from 2003. John's a very innovative, he's a history major by training, but a super brilliant guy, and he has this vision that he would lay out. So he partnered with a company called St. Ange Studio, and this was about the same time that Nick Mounts was founding Kiva Robotics, which is now Amazon Robotics. So many of you have probably seen Amazon Robotics, where they have the robots that drive on the floor and move around these racking systems. John was thinking we probably need to do something 3D to get the density and the storage density that would be required for a grocery operation. And one thing I'll point out here is that we had ramps going up to go to the different levels, but he didn't quite know how to make those work. And the other thing was, to the right of this picture, there's robots going out to the right and left. Hadn't really worked out the density of traffic, how to get these bots all to one location for the picker, but it was a great visual and a great vision John had as far back as 2003. He got detoured a little bit. He met some others. John's very good at networking. He met a gentleman from the C&S Grocery Wholesalers. They're one of the largest grocery wholesale companies. And they said, that's a really neat vision, but we need something for storing cases of products that get distributed out to grocery stores. So this is a system that John conceived where he solved the problem of going to different levels. Instead of having the bots, he didn't know how to make the bots go up and down the ramps and do that, but he came up with these kind of green and red rotating lifts that would allow the cases to get moved to the different levels for the robots to move. So this is the actual implementation then of that system. So it gives you an idea how big of a vision. So again, John just has this kind of animation idea, and within a few years was able to, this is the guy he hired away from me, made this a reality of doing this. So these are where they take cases of products in that are full pallets of cases from a manufacturer like Campbell's Soup or a soup company. And then they need to ship out mixed case pallets. So mixed items that go out to the grocery store, because a grocery store doesn't need a full pallet of tomato soup. They just need a case or two of tomato soup. And then here's the robot that is mixing that pallet to go out. So very successful company. And again, I was still at my previous company, and my previous employee was doing very nice working with John on this solution. And John, he wanted to get back to the grocery stores and retail was his passion, and he wanted to get back. So he started over in 2011. I'd sold his interest in CasePick, which is now Symbotic. And that's me there. We met and reconnected and started talking about, is there a way that we could really do what his original dream was, to have robotics and systems that go into grocery stores. And at the time, the idea of putting mobile robots in grocery stores, it seemed far-fetched. Most grocery stores and retailers would say, we're not going to have robots in that store for a long time. And nowadays, it's very different, that I'll talk about more. John and I, this is our rendition. I spent many Saturdays working on concepts, and the real problem we solved was how to make the robot go vertical. And by doing so, what you're seeing in the picture is, in the back, there's a blue storage structure, the blues containing all the products that you find in a grocery store. It could be bananas and mayonnaise and eggs and ketchup and everything else. And then these robots are bringing the storage tote out to the pickers. And at the same time, other robots are bringing bags or totes containing just order bags. And this is where now the picker is able to transfer from the product tote and complete and sort it into the order tote. Once the order is complete, the robots take the order back into the storage system and then ultimately deliver it to the customer. So, you know, what you're seeing here just in these nine locations is about 3 to 4 times the volume of most grocery stores. But it's in a footprint that's probably 1/10 the area of a grocery store. And the people that are picking in this video, they're picking between 800, or in this video, they're actually up to 1,200 items per hour. Grocery stores now have Amazon created the demand in the market for people that like to have their groceries be able to pick up or deliver to their home. So the way stores are responding to that is they hire people to go up and down the aisles, just like you do. And most people don't realize, when you go grocery shopping, you're essentially an unpaid warehouse worker going up and down the store warehouse, picking your own order. If you're not doing it, then the store needs to hire people to do it. In the store, pickers can pick about 80 to maybe a maximum of 100 items per hour. So when you think about, most grocery orders are 40 items or so, there's at least a half hour of labor, which ends up being 10 or 15% of sales just in the picking out prospects. So it's a very tough proposition for grocers. And I think that's very much where we came in, is there's a pain point now as the grocery market is evolving. And John had thought about it in advance, and maybe it's now the right time and technology. So John met with Walmart. He was actually avoiding Walmart. We thought they would be big and nasty and try to steal all of our IP. It turned out they've been a blessing to work with and provided development funding, and can't say enough good things about how they've really been a collaborative partner to us. It's funny how sometimes you think that's a company that you wouldn't want to engage with, but it turned out that they've been a very good partner. A lot of this, though, goes back to, again, John had the vision, John had the animations, but a lot of what he needed was, how do you make an animation into real automation? That's John there on the picture on the right, in our friend's basement, Joe. That's looking at, how do we, a robot would transfer the totes with the products in and out of storage shelves. So we came up with a simple chain conveyor. And then on the left is in my friend Joe Mack's garage. This is where we were showing how we can make a bot move from moving horizontally, like many robots can do, and shuttle storage systems to then having it convert into an elevator. We did all this just as a hobby. This was most of my weekends driving. This was actually in Manchester, New Hampshire, we talked about earlier. I was driving from Saratoga Springs to Manchester, New Hampshire on weekends, and just so we could play on the weekends and do this type of work. Just a little bit more about Walmart. Again, networking. So John Lert, again, I say his name a lot. He's a brilliant guy and a great partner. He had been networking with a Harvard professor in retail, and the Harvard professor was at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, and ran into the CEO of Walmart, Doug McMillon. And Doug had said, we're looking for automation. We've scoured the earth looking for an automation system that's compact and reliable and low cost enough to work in a grocery store. And fortunately, the Harvard professor said, well, you really should talk to my friend John Lert. So just a fun part of the story is they had codenamed Project Alpha within Walmart, which was top secret and only known by maybe the top 10 executives within Walmart. And when John went and pitched our Project Alpha bot to Walmart, the CEO kind of glared at everybody thinking that they had leaked the project or the secret information, but just a total coincidence that we had independently developed the Alpha bot that was ultimately adopted by Walmart. So that meeting was in February, and by August, in just about whatever that is, 6 months, we had reached an agreement and actually started a company. A lot of the challenge then became, don't underestimate the work in building a team. So we had pre-recruited 8 people that from our network. So I'd been talking nights and weekends and convincing, you know, along with John, that this is going to be a great startup and a great thing to do. And a lot goes back to networking and your reputation, that people want to come work with you. We pulled from our network and a relationship of about 30 years. Today, we're about 190 people. And a lot of, again, credit goes to John for really, he focuses a lot on the culture. I've spent a lot of time focusing on the technology, making sure that we have a very place where people love to work and want to be at work and enjoy it. Just one thing I'll mention about leveraging our experience and network. One of the reasons that Walmart had confidence in funding us was not just the technology or even that John had done it before. It was very much about convincing them that we had a team that came from an area that would bring applicable knowledge and capability. So this video that's kind of playing fast, I hope it's not too jerky, but this is inside of the GlobalFoundries factory they had shared on a video of inside the semiconductor factory. And semiconductor automation is very advanced in terms of its reliability requirements, as well as just the depth of technology and software to control their mobile robots that run on the ceiling. That was one of the things we recruited out of this industry, and I think it gave us a big head start over most automation or companies that had been trying to adapt automation, that we came in with the paradigm of we get to shut the system down once a year, not once a day, in terms of the robustness and reliability of design. Really bringing that type of experience from another industry was very beneficial to convincing Walmart that we could really do things that other people can. This is a quick timeline. This is our startup team of 8. Started up quickly. Within 6 months, we developed our first prototype of the robot. So this is where you'll see the robot move horizontally and then be able to transition into an elevator and move vertically. Just to give you an idea, the most advanced automation and kind of current state-of-the-art automation is what's called a shuttle. And it's just a robot that goes up and down an aisle. And then when it gets off to the aisle, it has to hand the tote off to an elevator. So our whole paradigm was we wanted to build a system that was only mobile robots that would do what all these other companies have to have, elevators and conveyors and a lot of other technology that once it breaks, then, you know, it wouldn't be suitable for a grocery application and it's too expensive. 18 months into the startup, we had a complete alpha system. So this was our first full designed integrated system. This is a video that's showing how the bots unload and load the totes and move to all the various locations. But I still find it amazing relative to John's original vision and animation, how much the real automation looks like that animation. Again, we put our first beta system in, started installing the first store 2 years in. So very proud of the fact we told Walmart executives that we would go from nothing to building, installing in a first store full-scale system in 2 years. Their attorney later told us that he was would have lost a lot of money because he was betting against us internally being able to do it. But very proud of the fact the team was able to do it. And this is a picture of the first installation. And again, at 30 months, we've grown to about 110 people. So networking, a lot of time in interviewing people, recruiting people, because when you get to this type of size now, you're outside of your immediate network. And you really have to spend time screening and understanding, getting the right people that both have the right knowledge and technology, but also fit your culture. This is our second system install in Arkansas. Walmart is very pleased and presented us to their, this is at their analyst day where they bring in all their stock market analysts. So it was a great opportunity for us to showcase our technology and at our second installation in Arkansas. And this just gives you an idea of the full scale of the system in Salem, New Hampshire. This is the full picking system that the robots store all the grocery products just to complete the orders. But a lot of work. It's not just the robot to develop, but also the software and all this mechanical structure we had to develop as well. So talking a little bit about how we did it, again, bringing knowledge from the semiconductor industry, we knew that we would have to focus on reliability. So no matter how good or superior our technology, if it doesn't work and it's not reliable, we're never going to get out of the gate. So as a team, we made sure we gathered and pulled everybody together to think about how are we going to prioritize? There's so much to do, and there's so many things we need to focus on. What are our priorities? So of course, we said safety first. Could not hurt somebody with this type of technology. Reliability. Our architecture itself is fault tolerant. And one of the things we designed in from the beginning is that with mobile robots only, if a mobile robot dies, there's always multiple paths to any location. So even if a robot is not operable, the system continues to run. And if you think about like a system with conveyors or elevators, once one of those breaks blocks the transport of everything else, not to mention you have to wait for a technician to show up with a part many times to repair it. And that's what retailers like Walmart have been burnt by, waiting for hours or days to fix a system, which obviously that's not going to work in a grocery store application with customers. These are test stands where we did accelerated testing of our wheels and chains and gear rack for having the bot climb. I don't want to be too salesy here. This just goes through some of the key things that they were looking for in a system. And again, for us having started from a white sheet of paper, that was really a key requirement that we, John, and you know, I joined him in the last couple of years to really study the problem, study the pain points of the grocer and what would be required. But a lot of it came down to density in terms of being small, density in terms of being a lot of throughput in a small area. And we achieved that by having the bots be able to move on all these stacked horizontal levels. But it also needed to be capitally efficient, and not to mention work in ambient chilled and frozen, which ended up being quite a bit of work. Sometimes you got to think about how you come up with these ideas. Let me go back to that. John had been thinking about ramps, and the only reason that we started talking about going vertical was we were filing patents. It's important to protect your technology, and we were writing patents on these mobile robots that could move three-dimensionally and bring the products and the order totes together. And we were at the time thinking about the bots going up and down ramps. And I said to John, I said, it's really important that we also cover, even if we don't know how to do it, we better make sure we cover, file a patent on the bot climbing vertically, because if that's not the next logical thing somebody would try to make better. So we started thinking about it, and then I remember the movie Goldfinger. I don't know if any of you have seen James Bond Goldfinger, but he has this cool Aston Martin where the centers of the wheel hub come out, the wheel spinners come out and cut up the spy's car next to him. And I thought, man, it'd be really cool if we could do something like that to where the climbing gear, the pinion gear, could come out on that same axle, because it would be a very simple design where that same motor that drives the wheel would drive our climbing pinion. And that's essentially the what was the genesis of the design. So you can see this picture now in the middle with the robot or the video, where there's a gear that extends out from the middle of the drive wheel. And so there's one direct drive servo motor on each side that drives that drive wheel. And then when we want to climb, the robot, we like to say, transforms into an elevator, where it extends out the gear. It goes into a gear rack as well as these red wheels that engage in a channel and let it turn into an elevator. You can see on the bottom right how that's happening. The other thing we do is not only does the pinion gears come out, but we also suck the wheels in. So this is like landing gear that when we want to go up to these different horizontal levels, we have to suck the wheels in so the bot can move between the levels. And when we get to the level we want to be on, we put the wheels out and sit down on that level. For me, this is just a passion. It was almost like a challenge or a hobby. And I'm very much into robotics and first robotics going back to my RPI mechanical engineering days. It was fun to be able to apply this type of idea. The other thing I'll mention real quick is our robots don't have any batteries. Most of our competitors have batteries, and batteries are a problem because they take time to charge, as well as even in some cases they can catch fire and other things. We use ultra capacitors. I pulled in, I said, there's a friend, I have Matt Cody. I went to a startup without him, electrical engineer, and we used ultra capacitors. The thing that are great about ultra capacitors versus batteries, they fully charge in about 15 or 20 seconds. So while we're moving vertically in these channels, you'll see in this picture in the middle, we have charge tows that come in and pick up power. So the bot is charging while it's moving vertically, which is also when it needs the most power to climb. So we never have to stop and charge. So just some fun videos of what it looks like from the bot's perspective moving through the system. So we do have 6 cameras on the bot, and as a startup and a business, we're always trying to think ahead in terms of how do we make this reliable and really robust. So these cameras are very beneficial for also debugging. If there's an error or an issue, we can go back and check the video. But also in the future, we'll use these to remote in. So think of it almost like an underwater submarine. So if there's an issue that we can recover from a remote location, if there's a blockage or a box of cereal sticking up or something like this. Not only did we have to design the bots themselves, we had to design all the structure system that support the bots. I won't go into that too much. These are the channels where they climb. Those are the yellow rails are the electrical power rails that the bots use to pick up power. And then this is just a video. You can see the bot kind of more clearly here, how it moves horizontally on a level. This is just a system in our lab where we're testing a new structure design. And then you can see how it transforms it into an elevator. And if you remember from that first video in the garage, very similar to what we're doing in the garage, just in a production bot now. We also needed to design our own tote. One thing we do differently, we do use subtotes. Many people would say, well, why don't you just use dividers? Well, the advantage of using these subtotes for containing groceries is this allows us to, and this is something that John had thought of and we spent a lot of time thinking about, is you want to be able to maximize the storage density. So by using these automatable subtotes that we can pick up with a robot, we can always do defragmentation, similar to disk defragmentation on a PC, that as the totes go empty, we can pluck the empty ones out and make the storage density much denser this way. And then this is just showing the automation I was referring to, how we can move them around automatically. It's probably one of the things that fouls up most startups, especially in automation, is software. It's always more complex and more difficult to perfect. I like to say we cheated. So the same software that was running semiconductor factories, again, through relationship, I introduced John Lurk to a gentleman named Rory Gagnon, who had a software company that was controlling the robots moving around semiconductor factories. So we were able to obtain a license to a source code and with an agreement that we would not compete in semiconductor, which of course we're in grocery, we don't care about semiconductor. We were able to take a license to the source code, and that was a big help in advancing our capability to control system that would control the robots. The lines you're seeing in this model, this is the simulation, but it's basically showing the path reservations. So our system works very much like air traffic control, where the bots are given paths where they're allowed to move and plan. And then as they go past those node points, those paths become available to be reserved for other robots. This is just a picture of a full-scale system. That's the same one I just showed in the video at the Salem system. These three aisles are all ambient. This aisle, the shorter aisle is chilled, and then the small aisle is frozen. So we had to spend a lot of time thinking about all the process and how to make it so that the bots can go between those various systems. This is just showing the real-life picker at the system. So this is where on the right side are the products coming in the totes. We do a pick and put to light, and then the picker picks from the tote and places. So another thing back to safety, we had to put a lot of evaluation in how to make this interface safe for the associate. I probably spend as much time thinking about how to engineer safety solutions as anything else in a system like this. So important as you think about a startup, it's easy to think about the happy path, but the work is really within all the exception cases and all the what ifs. And DuPont has something called the what if analysis. We spend a lot of time using what if as well as the FAMEAs, the failure mode effects analysis, where you're thinking about what are all the possible failure modes and then ranking them for severity, likelihood of occurrence, and detectability. And then using that to prioritize your work. A lot of work has to go into that. Of course, I'm sure some of you are thinking, well, wow, that's a really crappy job, having to transfer those products constantly at those kind of rates. It's a natural extension of our technology that we are now integrating robots that can do that pick and put capability. Arms aren't as fast as people. We tested people can go as high as 1,500 items per hour. Robots today can do 400 to 600, but then it becomes a more of a business case of how do you maximize the value. So what you might want to think about is that during peak periods where you have to do a lot of orders fast, you use humans. But then in the off hours, you can, especially where you have orders that are ordered ahead, you can use robots that just plug away on a more continuous basis. There's a lot of business thought that has to go into a startup like this, modeling as well as just the pure technology. This just gives us some more statistics on the deploying and scaling. One of the key challenges we have now, these are big systems, big automation systems. And for these customers like Walmart, one of the challenges that you think about is how do we scale fast enough? So one thing, the hardest part was 2 years proving the technology works and these robots can climb and do all the stuff we promised. But a company like Walmart, you have to be able to scale pretty quickly because their business is such a large scale that unless you can fill a significant need of their stores or it becomes not of interest to them. I'll let you think about that and I'll tell you in a minute like one of the ways we're doing that. This is just a video of the actual store up in Salem, New Hampshire. I think I'll skip this one in the sake of time, but this is just, again, how the robots pick up and drop off. Again, Walmart's been a very good partner to us. Again, John was avoiding them in the beginning, and we were concerned about them wanting to steal our IP, but in the end, they've been a great partner to us. It's hard to not say enough good things about them in terms of their willingness to collaborate. We were doing pretty good and pretty happy to have Walmart's business, but now COVID, it's in a terrible way to get attention, but it certainly is driving the business in this area. So sometimes I guess it's just a matter of being in the right place at the right time. We thought we were in the right place in the right time to getting the acceptance of robots into grocery and this idea of micro-fulfillment centers where now the automation's at the store level. But you can see in this chart that online grocery is one of the fastest of all growing, especially now with COVID, how it's changing the environment. One of the other things, too, is don't underestimate how quickly markets evolve. John had it in part of his initial vision that not only would we pick the orders, but we would have the ability for the robots to drive out of the building and then go down and deliver to these types of pickup portals. We thought this would be 3 or 4 years down the road. We're now deploying these and starting to do this now. And the market changes very quickly, and it's a challenge to keep up with this type of opportunity. So getting a little bit to how do we scale fast enough, some of the challenges of a startup are you need cash and you need the ability to scale. So another relationship I had in my life was with a company, Muratech of Japan, who I've also been amazed by their capabilities, their engineering and manufacturing. So we reached out to them and said, look, we've designed this robot for grocery, but it really could compete with anything in the storage and retrieval systems very effectively. So we were able to grant a license, an IP license, which helped us with cash in the short term. I think more importantly, we've thought about this at a bigger level, that now we can collaborate. So our new structure and even our new robot version we're putting out is being done with in conjunction with Murata, who has about 6,000 employees and 1,000 engineers. This is definitely helping our ability to scale for Walmart. Along with, we did have to select partners like Plexus, who's one of the largest contract manufacturers. that we can turn out many of these robots on the order of thousands of robots at a time to satisfy the demand of the retailer. I have talked a lot about Walmart today. I just want to clarify, we're not exclusive to them. They don't own any equity in the company. We are very committed to making them successful because they did provide the initial funding and support of our company. And finally, I think it's important, John, getting back to his long-term vision, it's very much that we have our eye on the ultimate store in the future. So when you go to a grocery store, essentially that whole center store is all the canned goods and all the packaged goods. And, you know, one jar of peanut butter is like any other jar of peanut butter, and one can of soup is like any other. John's vision is that we automate all that, but we want to preserve the market for the fresh goods. So many people still enjoy coming to the market to pick their own steak or pick their own vegetables or fruit. So this is our vision for the store of the future. Today, most grocery stores are on the order of 80,000 square feet or more. So this is on a footprint, it's about a quarter of the space. What's novel about this to really disrupt the market, and it's something you have to think about, is how are you going to disrupt the market, is that we have a much better operating cost than a traditional grocery store, the way this operates. But there's also a lower capital cost, and it's very unusual to have a scenario where you have a lower operating cost and a lower capital cost. And at the same time, you're making the customer's life better. There's a lot of thought that needs to go into of what problem are you solving, how is it really differentiated, and what are the economics behind it? I think in this case, I think that's why Walmart realized that this type of solution where you automate at the store level was the answer, because you get all three. You get the better customer experience, you have better, or you have lower operating cost and lower initial end cost. I guess the things to walk away with from this whole story were, a lot of this was purely following something I wanted to do in innovation, something I'm very interested in, robotics. I love robotics and inventing stuff. But every bit as much as it is about the technology, it was about the relationships. My relationship I had with John, that could have been one that, well, he's my enemy for life because he hired my best engineer away, but kept an open mind and turned out to be the best partner a person could have. It's about the, you know, all the people throughout my career in semiconductor that were willing to come and work with me again. You could really pull the right team together. So that was very important. As a startup, there's nothing better, I don't think, of having someone that's willing to invest in your company that's also a customer. So obviously they had a vested interest in supporting us and making us successful. So that was a very key point. Building a company that's just a great place to work. So we're very focused on culture. We have very many nice policies. I won't try to do recruiting on here and now, but we have very many nice perks and benefits and policies where it's a great place to work. But we really hire people that love their work, want to, you know, work with others.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Impactful Innovators podcast series. Be sure to continue listening as we explore more of the stories of entrepreneurs and innovators as they go through the challenging process of changing the world. Thank you again to the National Science Foundation and the Severino Center for Technological Entrepreneurship for making this podcast possible. If you enjoyed the podcast, please subscribe to the Severino Center for Technological Entrepreneurship on YouTube, share it with a friend, or connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. We hope that this series will help inspire the next generation of innovators, entrepreneurs at Rensselaer and beyond.